Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research here at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund intelligence. I'm super excited to say I have a special guest on today, Mark Hirschberg, Managing Partner and CEO of Topaz Capital. Mark oversees the origination and structuring of all investment activities, as well as acquisitions, business development, investor relations, and overall strategic direction. Mark, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me on the show.
Absolutely. Mark, I want you to run through a little bit of your background with us today. I know that you got involved in real estate at a very young age. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yes, absolutely. I appreciate the opening for that. So yeah, I started really young and I managed to purchase a small triplex in the local area in New Jersey, where I live in Northern New Jersey, shout out to Bergen County. Spent a lot of time there fixing up the asset and then selling it, as well as managing a little portfolio of my own in equities. And that gave me the exposure to real estate on the equity side. I was also doing some REIT investing on both debt and equity on the REIT side. Ended up going into working for UBS during college, ended up staying with them for a little while after graduation, and ultimately was fortunate enough to get some exposure to the real estate book of business at UBS, CMBS, as well as mortgages for UBS clients, and then rolling up those mortgages and selling them off and that whole process. So that was a fantastic experience, and then just created a greater itch, ultimately morphed into a more of an appetite to want to get more in the weeds on real estate and continue down that road, which led to obviously working, UBS on more on the real estate side and then financing side. And then same goes for Brick Capital on private equity and debt, as well as doing some side deals with the broker's license on assemblages in Manhattan and elsewhere in New York City, and then ultimately launching out of there, Topaz. But that was a great early start.
So what was the opportunity you saw when you were starting to launch Topaz?
The opportunity I saw was that there was a tremendous amount of legislation, anti-landlord legislation, coming up on the horizon. I'm dating ourselves back to 2016-17 is where it started, with the famous headliners calling landlords the sledgehammers, the enemy, treating their tenants to the level that they feel like they must have been treated, and the real estate ultimately getting more scrutinized in terms of violations and things of that nature. And yet the cap rates were still compressing. And from my perspective, as I said, how is a cap rate still compressing, especially in the Bronx? And you have all these high risk variables on a legislative side, as well as regulatory and legislative sides that are only deepening as the time goes. And so I said to everyone, most people called me crazy or lost my marbles, if you will, by saying that there's something devastating coming for the industry, redistribution of wealth by the legislators and local regulators. And that was where I said, okay, we have to go outside. I went to more favorable locations, but not by much. At that point, it was Philadelphia. And then I realized they're just slightly behind New York City in the same issue. But I was backed by my former bosses, which was a real honor and privilege and tremendous opportunity for me to be able to go in and partner with them and syndicate their book of business and their relationships, and invest my own capital that we made all working for them and roll it into transactions and deals. But ultimately, I realized that's still an issue. This is 2018. And so we divested from the Northeast and then rolled everything in, made a big bet on Florida, more specifically Jacksonville, Florida, about $150 million. That was an econ market analysis more than anything else, where we saw that there was a tremendous affordability component vis-a-vis all the other major MSAs in Florida, and that the MSA has tremendous potential that's not been unlocked yet. That was our bet. We fortunately did very well with that bet and managed to predominantly 1031 exchange over a lot of those assets, and in other cases, exit it. So that was kind of the journey there. And, you know, what was a pleasure is that a lot of people that called me crazy ended up reaching out and asking if we have opportunities to invest, as well as people asking for guidance and advice. Even though we were only a couple of years earlier than them, it allowed us a competitive edge in the marketplace.
Great. So you were armed with this thesis and you were armed with some capital from some of your former bosses, pivoted a bit away from the Northeast and down into Florida. So that kind of brings you to today. What does Topaz look like right now? How big is your portfolio? What's your team look like?
Absolutely. So today we started with just two of us, myself and my partner, Eitan Freeman, and who's a former TreeTop employee. And we essentially did everything between the two of us. Today we're looking at 4 front office, 4 back office. So we still believe we should stay nimble and lean and mean. Whatever we can outsource, we outsource. Whatever we can't, whatever we don't think is accretive to the portfolio and to the business, we don't. And it's predominantly asset management, investment management, acquisitions, dispositions, and more recently, ground up multifamily development of very similar to what we own and operate and asset manage today. And on top of all that, we do. We also offer some creative lending solutions, alternative, what we call alternative financing or direct lending. And that's really to help fellow sponsors in Florida, fellow multifamily Florida sponsors of a certain vintage criteria and unit count to help get them through a challenging period with the ultimate goal and desire of us participating in some form in equity down the road, whether it's an opportunity to buy the deal, get first look, or if it's a opportunity for us to potentially recapitalize the deal with them. So that it's really a more of an entry point and helps us build out the pipeline, as well as offer a creative structuring by having a modest sized debt platform to tap into. And then outside of that, everything else is complementary to the business. So our prop tech investments, a total of 4 or 5 at this moment, well, about to be 5, is all feeding the core business. And that's the goal, is to invest in what we believe is will add enhanced value of our business. And those investments are made personally at the executive level of the company.
So, you know, for a small company, it sounds like you guys have a pretty wide scope. You finance, you own, you operate. Sounds like you have prop tech investments as well. What's the rationale behind that decision?
Because we have honed in and become such a niche-oriented investor, meaning we only cover the Florida geography. And within that, we don't go deep into the panhandle. We don't go down to the Florida Keys for obvious insurance reasons and market growth reasons due to the recurrence of devastation in those markets on a too frequent period for us to get comfortable. So we basically realized we're geographically already narrowed down in our scope, and vintage wise, typically, you know, 1990 or newer vintage product is on acquisitions, and then ground up, we're going on smaller assets as well. And what we believe is areas that are, call it attainable housing. So because our investment criteria is more specific than our competitor base, and therefore opportunities are fewer, we feel that we have to offer more on our side to be able to see more viable opportunities in today's environment.
So you mentioned attainable, and I like that word. I know that in some of your previous materials, you've mentioned workforce housing or Class B housing. What's the reason for focusing on that specifically in the Florida region?
Great question. So Florida, if you follow a lot of the data trends, you're seeing a tremendous lack of affordability for renters and owners and home buyers. What's fantastic is that there's been tremendous growth and migration. In contrast to that, you've seen a lot of people unable to keep up with their lifestyles and have to make a sacrifice somewhere. And so what we've been finding is our thesis has been playing out true, whereby people are willing to live farther away from their jobs or from the urban cores, partly because of the whole COVID landscape on the backdrop over the last 5 years, but also in large part due to Florida being a fairly drivable market for the most part. So we're starting to see this willingness for people to live a little bit further out. We're seeing that people are needing to live in, let's call it, non-class A or non-ultra luxury communities, for the sake of having A, more space, B, more affordability, and C, still living in the general area or the MSA where they want to be living. So that's the trend we've been seeing, and we've been trying to continue to stay ahead of the curve in terms of our investment criteria to accommodate for that trend. And part of that is understanding that Class A luxury is a great product, but doesn't work in many markets. And Class C is very much a function of government contracts, usually, and other types of, let's call it, federal or local funding. So, you know, there's this kind of very underserved space, rather, which we call middle market or middle America housing. And that's the Class B space. And that's why we're so bullish on workforce, and which is blue and gray collar, typical employees that live in those communities. And it works. And the model works as long as those employees continue to retain jobs and that their employers are not too cyclical. Also, on top of which, not having too much of a concentration of a single employer at a property. That's essentially our outlook and investment thesis.
So what are some of the recent deals you've done?
More recently, very much along the fairway, what we spoke about. So your blue collar, gray collar workers. So we purchased a 229 unit in Melbourne. That's a Class B, turned it into a B plus asset, mostly exterior value add. We were not finding the same risk-adjusted return profile. It's hard to reconcile it in terms of heavy value add today, both interior and exterior, in the market where we're in more stagnant, or let's call it sub 3% rental rate growth markets, at least at this current time and over the past few years. So we've been focusing in more on deals that have good in-place cash flow. That was a great in-place cash flow deal with upside. And we continue to not only make distributions where we said we would, but increase the value of the asset, tenancy base, and so on and so forth. So that was a nice deal, purchased really well. So I think we made the money on the buy and then just continue to increase the value. Prior to that was more of a Class A asset, actually, but it's Class A, I would say, gray collar. So it's still your quote-unquote workforce housing, just upper tier workforce housing. So you'll have some high-end paid nurses and NPs and PAs, but you're not going to have your doctors per se, or you're going to have your kind of around 90,000 MHI type tenancy base. So that's really where we focus. We focus from like your 65,000-70,000 MHI, depending on the market and the deal profile, to 120,000. Anything above that, we feel, becomes not only hyper-competitive, therefore compressing cap rates and increasing pricing and making hard to make money on the buy.
Mark, I think one of the things that was really interesting, you mentioned you recently launched a 1031 exchange platform. Do you want to tell us a little about that?
Absolutely. So 1031 is actually recently launched in terms of formality and publishing purposes as a true platform. Essentially, the platform existed prior to, but it wasn't a free platform. It was more of, we had so many 1031 clients coming to us, whether it's first generation, second generation, third generation, whatever it might be. And these family offices and ultra high net worth individuals were saying, well, guys, you've done a bunch of these before. If you could help us.
How about you legitimize this?
Yeah. How do we legitimize this? We're doing it. We're doing it programmatically. Why don't we create a structure for it? So we said, okay, let's think about all the different components to ensuring the deal's success. And of course, you want to think about what the biggest risks are first, and then back in for the biggest risks to who are the professionals that help mitigate that risk. And then how do those professionals need to be plugged in to the deal process at what given time, depending on where they are within their 1031 process? So it is a bit of a science. It's more of a science than it is anything else, and substance more than form. And that's where we brought in 1031. We have a list of essentially a questionnaire that gets plugged into our database that, based on the responses to the questionnaire, we assign a deal to that investor in that scenario. And in cases where we can't place it ourselves, their exchange, we will then assist them in placing it elsewhere and no additional cost, just to grow the relationship. And we'll usually use a top 10 sponsor, someone that we've co-invested with or currently co-invested with, or a leader in the space. For example, there's many cases where I can give 1031 investors to Harbor Group International and others, not only due to the close relationship we have with the principals, but primarily due to the fact that they have a great reputation and we feel confident that they're going to do well by that investor. So that's really what the idea of the platform allows: relationships to come in and have a high probability that we can help execute.
So, Mark, I want to draw our conversation out a little bit, or rather one step up. I think you have some great insights on the multifamily landscape in Florida to do your investment thesis that we already talked about. But I think this is a market that saw a massive boom during the pandemic, a huge influx in net migration, drove rents up, attracted a lot of capital. And then you're dealing with insurance concerns, profound affordability challenges. Florida seems like it's had a really wild ride. Has this changed the Topaz thesis at all?
It didn't change our investment thesis and our bullish long-term outlook, because all data, fundamental econ data I synthesize, is pointing towards long-term growth and continued growth. Even migration has only dropped sub 35% from the peak of COVID's in migration to Florida, which is incredibly impressive. And if you look at Orlando statistics and Tampa statistics, they've absorbed the majority of the oversupply, at least narrative. At least at the time, we thought it was a tremendous oversupply narrative. Us and many other sponsors set up vehicles to take advantage of a lot of oversupply in these markets. And to our surprise, for the better, for the worse, those deals weren't around and they got absorbed and they're getting leased up. Sure, it took longer and gave them more concessions, but it was not nearly as painful as we thought it would be. So you're still seeing incredible fundamentals, and you're still seeing all the same legislative and regulatory and tax and all that other stuff that people are obviously very concerned about in today's society and real estate landscape is most favorable still in Florida. So there's a very meaningful, for the size of the state and being only one of many states, it's an incredible economic powerhouse. So that's something that we feel very bullish about long-term and remain that way. So that's unwavering. Now, from the perspective of, have we had to pivot according to insurance, payroll, marketing, and all those other things going up? Sure. By no means are other states isolated from this issue. Like no other state, California with wildfires and Nashville and Texas with snowstorms freezing over pipes and destroying properties. And right. So all these like kind of these wild card events that no one ever expected in markets that were considered low risk insurance markets are not as low risk as we all thought. Right. There's a bigger event where it's sure that maybe you're more inland, you're less exposed, but then you still have places like Tennessee who have tornadoes. So you're constantly falling into this situation of people are saying, hey, Florida and Texas and Georgia or Alabama or certain states that are the most exposed and to insurance, yes and no, right? Yes, in recent history over a 50-year period, they're correct on data, but they are not accounting for all the recent events that have occurred that they couldn't even forecast. So that's something that we are very aware of. We've hedged against it by joining master policy, shared and layered convoluted policies, candidly, that help us get bargaining terms while still having adequate coverage and robust coverage, rather, for the properties. So that's one thing. That was a big one. Obviously, insurance is a big one. And then in terms of how we hedge against other areas like taxes and water and sewer, things of that nature, we basically continue to have a very strong alliance with our partners at Ryan Tax and other leading firms, whereby we really dive in on a quarterly basis to where could we potentially have savings, and then align those that are going to pursue them with us, align interests accordingly. So that's another area. Marketing and payroll has kind of been across the country. Sure, it's been a little more in the states that are most competitive with oversupply. It's just a natural function of that. It's a natural kind of progression narrative where you have a lot of competition. You get to be spending more dollars in your marketing. So Texas has seen a tremendous amount. Arizona, all the states, Nashville, and all these kind of cities that have seen tremendous development growth, housing development growth, and hyper-competitive environments, because a lot of people tend to build, especially institutions in close proximity to one another, have had to spend a lot more money. And then, of course, it doesn't help when you have these, let's call it lawsuits between large ERPs, without saying names, that are trying to control certain pricing and marketing dollars and things like that. So a lot of that has been on the chopping block by regulators, for the better, for the worse, but for the better for the long term, without a doubt, and helping investors not experience tremendous upticks on operating costs. And then in terms of overall outlook, in terms of what we're buying, we also are buying newer product, better built products. to hedge against a lot of that risk that we just spoke about. So we're buying some newer product now, mostly 90s or 85 and newer, and certain deals that are that we consider to be home runs or slam dunks, if you will. And then we're doing now, we also got it to BTR more recently with one of our partners, shout out to Arbor Realty Trust and a few other partners that have been incredibly instrumental in our ability to understand and get competitive in the BTR space here as well. And we're finding that space to be incredibly, let's call it infancy stages of its growth narrative, and to be incredibly creative for multifamily investors so they can have the opportunity to also participate in BTR, not just multifamily. So those are some of the things we're doing on our end to hedge against it. And I would say where most guys are looking to say, hey, I want to own a property on the water in certain locations because it's quote unquote sexy or it's appealing or it's something you could talk about or create view for your tenant. We're not of that case. We actually prefer to be more inland. We prefer to be out of flood zones. And we also just prefer it from a overall deterioration of the asset due to saltwater standpoint as well. So we try to be in excess of 10 minutes at least drive from either coast, even if the deal is a great deal, unless there's some unique narrative whereby they can't be destructed, right? Or it's really hard to destruct it. For example, I went to a deal recently that we're working on that's 80s vintage that has metal roofing and concrete block. It's basically a bunker. So in that case, yes, they're susceptible to damage. It's a market in the Southwest near the Gulf. It's still outside of 10 minutes. So yes, it applies to our rule of thumb, but it's maybe a 20-minute drive, right? Or 15, 20-minute drive to the coast. But in that case, you're dealing with a very strong, essentially fortress, where if things do happen, they're going to be mostly interior damage, which is really, you're able to mitigate that risk with an insurance policy, as opposed to seeing it as building destruction damage, which would be a really long time to get those units back online and have major business interruptions. So we have pivoted tremendously to account for where we are today by all the things I just mentioned earlier, and I'm sure I'm missing others, but feel free to delve into that further if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was a great overview of some of the risks you guys deal with when thinking through some of these deals. As a follow-up to that, and you did mention a few of them, but do you think that as a result, there are any markets or submarkets you think are currently way overvalued or due to some of those risks, or maybe some that are undervalued that are less risky than folks might think?
Absolutely. I think the markets that are most exposed to insurance risk, specifically wind and storm damage, those markets that are also hyper-supplied in combination with that. So there's essentially a dichotomy going on of your high insurance risk exposure to also existing high vacancy rates due to oversupply narrative. That's exactly where we want to be today, as long as we can mitigate that risk, of course. But that's where we want to be today, because it's only a matter of time till that supply, again, we have to believe that supply could get absorbed, and we have to actually see that the data proving the supply getting absorbed in the near term over a 5-year hold or 7-year or 10-year, depending on the investor that's participating in the deal. But we're always going to look at that narrative and we say, hey, that's where we want to be. We want to be in the place that has the highest ever record of vacancy rate, and economic vacancy rate rather is more important than anything else. Economic vacancy rate at a property, because there's only upwards to go from here. Again, we have to be able to see the migration still happening. We'll be able to see other economic fundamentals still have positive economic fundamentals and drivers still occurring for us to participate and saying, hey, those aren't going to tremendously slow down in the near term or long term in order for us to make that bet. And then on the insurance side, you just have to hedge accordingly. So some cases, it means we're penciling $2,000 a unit, even if it's the master or standalone policy, to hedge against that risk. But you know, that $2,000 is the difference of us walking away with an insurance claim with some dollars back for our investors to compensate them for the time and headache and the lack of cash distributions during that period. So everything's taken into account. And the same applies on the contrary, whereby there are markets that are in central, like for example, Orlando, if, depending on where you buy a deal, you are overpaying most of the time, especially if you're Class A in Orlando, MSA, in the better pockets, because there's a flight of vintage premium going on. So the newer the product, the higher the premium purchase is. Premium cost is in place, A. And B, due to the fact that it's most inland,
and it's not a flood zone and all those things, and it's a really risk-averse deal, you're going to have institutions or very sophisticated long-term family office investors willing to pay a premium for that product in a time where we don't believe premium should be applied, at least within reason. We're finding that the premium being paid here is almost 2x percentage-wise on where we think it should be.
So it sounds like you've got a lot of on-the-ground knowledge. The state of Florida is not a one-size-fits-all. All the different markets have their own risks and opportunities. I imagine that makes it more difficult for foreign investors or out-of-state investors to really be in the Florida market. Do you see a lot of appetite, or do you see a lot of competition from folks that aren't as experienced with the market?
Yes. So I do think so. I think it takes a lot of local knowledge, to your point. But funny enough, I haven't really seen the slowdown in foreign investment capital as of late into Florida. Actually, in fact, to the contrary, we're seeing, you know, maybe certain markets in Florida, but overall in Florida, we're still seeing tremendous appetite. We have a ton of groups, large family offices from Europe, Israel in some cases, Latin America and Central America, right? So we're seeing still a lot of interest from foreign capital. What we are finding is that they're taking a lot longer due diligence. And their question is, do you actually have that time and wherewithal and bandwidth to get them there? And that's a different question, which for a great deal, we're finding it very challenging to do that. For a forward sale deal or a market rate price deal, that's more achievable because people are willing to say, hey, I'll work with you on timing. I'll work with you on these things that you're up against for the family office semester. It's first time foreign investors, and this is their, let's call it, first entrance into the U.S. market. It's a different conversation as well. I would underscore my prior statement even further by saying their ramp up time, they're most likely going to pass in the first few deals until they get a tremendous sense of comfortability. That's also something is that you have to be a shrewd steward of capital, understanding what they need. And then you have to give them those deals ahead of time to say, hey, we know we just have to educate them on a few deals and a few investment opportunities prior to them actually pulling trigger. But then they ultimately do. So that's also another element is you have to know your customer here is my comment. And ideally speaking, you want them to already have their capital domesticated. You don't really want to be part of them domesticating their capital unless it's for a certain strategy and the contribution commitment amount by that investment group is large enough, meaningful enough to take all that time, invest all that money and resources.
So it sounds like you need a lot of at least data sources and kind of other information on the ground in Florida to understand some of these deals. I know that when we spoke before I brought you on, that you mentioned Topaz has actually been a Reonomy customer for a long time. I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you guys use that and if that's helpful in operating in the Florida market at all.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're very familiar with you guys at Altus via Reonomy, actually, initially back in 2020. I think we've been on with them actually prior to COVID. I think it was like 2018. And essentially, yes, it's been a tremendous information tool to see not only the dynamics of the asset where it stands, but also the ownership groups and what else they own, when their maturity dates are. So it's a tremendous data analytics resource for us. And it's also a very helpful software to use for sourcing deals as well. So we use it for both data analytics sourcing, as well as understanding markets based on what kind of investors are already in the markets and what that trend looks like in terms of entrance.
Excellent. I want to use the last kind of section of our conversation here to round things out. I want to hear a little bit about your outlook for multifamily. I think in a lot of your kind of appearances in other media, you've said that you believe that multifamily is a safe haven asset class. Do you still believe this, and why or why not?
So I do. I think that, you know, leading housing economists all agree that the fundamentals for multifamily are still there. There still is a nationwide housing shortage. There still is a tremendous need for rentals, especially in a high interest rate environment where buying homes is very unachievable and very unaffordable. So yeah, the underlying fundamentals have not changed. It's more, what do you do at the time with turbulence and how do you navigate that turbulence? And so I definitely highly recommend people to continue to invest in multifamily while understanding that there has been recent pains through the top of the cycle whereby people were buying deals at really aggressive cap rates just because debt was really cheap, almost free in some cases. And that made people get overly aggressive. And that's the classic narrative of greed in business and capitalism. And that has to be suppressed. We're all guilty of it to some extent, but there has to be an acknowledgement and self-awareness to that level. And then I would say it's also going to be heavily dependent on the thesis within housing. So I wouldn't say multifamily should just be blindly investing in multi. It should be multi that's whatever the investment is. Let's say the thesis is to have the property serve a certain clientele, but the clientele is not going to come to the market, is not currently in the market, then it's not a sound investment. So it's really becomes more a function of the deal profile on the market in which it's in, and then the economic drivers around all that is what I would say. So it requires, I think it's fairly dynamic and requires a lot of studying, but I think within that studying, there has to be an element of prudence and also really just meticulous and thorough due diligence on every transaction. I would say that as multifamily, we're going to make the most return is markets first, deals second. That's our thesis. That's our mantra. So underwrite the market first, believe in the growth narrative. If you do, then go for the deal. If you don't believe in the market, don't believe in the thesis on the market level and the economics, then your deal could only do so well because markets ultimately will drive a higher, historically have driven a higher return profile if the market grows versus, let's call it, top tier execution at the business level.
I love that. Great answer. And thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I do think that's all the time we have, but want to also thank our listeners for tuning in. But Mark, thank you so much. Take care until the next episode of Sierra Exchange.
Absolutely. Appreciate you having me on the show.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.